I really don't enjoy being this shy. I used to convince my little sister to go and talk for me. This is my thing. I would push her forward and get her to ask for things that I wanted. And I decided, you know what? I don't like living like this. It's uncomfortable and it's not what I want.
That's how success happens. From Entrepreneur Magazine, my name is Robert Tuckman. I self-funded, built up, and eventually sold two businesses to major players in the sports and entertainment industry. And I am fascinated by other entrepreneurial minds and what drives high-achieving people. So on this podcast, we're going to learn what they've learned and what it takes to really succeed. Here's the nightmare scenario for entrepreneurs. You put in a ton of time, effort, labor, and love. You create something exciting and meaningful. And then you lose it all and end up with nothing. It's a common story, unfortunately. Entrepreneurship is hard, and it doesn't always work out. But rarely has someone experienced this as dramatically and publicly as Leslie Echols. Leslie Echols is the co-founder and former head of marketing of FanDuel, the billion-dollar fantasy sports company. She started it with her husband Nigel in a tiny office in Scotland, and it went on to help change the law about sports betting across America. But despite the company's success, Leslie and Nigel didn't get to enjoy the spoils. Their relationship with their investors fell apart, and they left the business in 2017, having made almost no money on the deal and retaining no interest in the business. Financially, it wasn't a very successful ending. So why did I want to talk to Leslie for a show called How Success Happens? Because while many people may quit after a big loss like that, Leslie didn't. She got back up, digested the lessons from her FanDuel experience, and decided to build something new, something that she was passionate about. She founded Relish, the first ever relationship training app that makes it easier to build happy, healthy, more connected relationships. So how do you pick yourself up and move on? To me, that is real success. And I wanted to find out how she did it. So I met with Leslie in Manhattan, where she commutes into from her home in Westchester. Coming up after the break, her tale of being down, but never out. There's a reason why active investors will often put their money into property. It can be a really strong investment with returns that beat the market. But of course, the average person in the past couldn't actually become an investor and part owner in real estate because of very strict rules about who is and isn't an accredited investor. But that has now changed. You can now co-own apartment complexes with investment minimums starting under $1,000 when you invest with DiversiFund. The investment process only takes 10 minutes. DiversiFund manages real estate deals from start to finish, cutting out the middlemen typically involved in the process, which allows them to cut all the platform and management fees commonly charged to investors, meaning you could get an even higher return. When you invest in commercial real estate, you're diversifying your portfolio and guarding against the volatility of the stock market. So take a look at what DiversiFund has to offer and how they can get you in on the action. Visit diversifund.com/entrepreneur. That's DiversiFund.com/entrepreneur. And now, on with the show. All right, we're back. So I wanted to know more about Leslie and how she was able to pick herself up and keep grinding. So that's what I asked her. How do you do it? And to answer that, she started by telling me of a story about herself as a little girl and how, at a young age, she figured out a way to handle life's challenges.
Right. Yeah. I mean, as a child, I was really shy. I was a complete introvert. I enjoyed sitting in my bedroom reading books. That was my thing. I played piano. It was, you know, I did some singing really badly, but you know, I wasn't one of these kids that was always out for the hustle from the word go. I wasn't building businesses in my bedroom. As I grew up and entered my teenage years, and I decided, you know what, I really don't enjoy being this shy. I used to convince my little sister to go and talk for me. This is my thing. I would push her forward and get her to ask for things that I wanted. And I decided, you know what? I don't like living like this. It's uncomfortable and it's not what I want.
Do you remember the moment when you really were like, wow, I just can't do this any longer. I'm not going to really grow.
Yeah, I don't think it was one particular moment. I just always felt that I wanted to do something major. I didn't know really what it was, but, you know, I grew up in quite a small town in the middle of Scotland, and I just always saw myself moving somewhere different and doing something different. Didn't really know what it was. And I started to just try and push myself every day to do something scary. And to this day, I still, like, if I look in my diary one day and realize I'm not doing something scary today, I'm quite surprised. And I think that's a good way to grow personally. And really just, you know, I talk to my team all the time about, none of us know really what we're doing here. We're all living outside of our comfort zone because we're doing something really special. And that's an exciting way to live.
Yeah, I agree. I think in the businesses I've been in or just always been about getting outside your comfort zone, because nothing really, you as a person or your business will never evolve if you don't just go for it. Right. And I love that sometimes it's like when I was building my business, it would be like, let's take the deal. Like, we'll figure it out. Yes, right. I'm outside my comfort zone and it's scary, but deep down I knew we'd get it done and we can do it. And it sounds like at a young age, you really figured that out, which has definitely led to you doing some really big things.
Right. You know, I was the first person in my family to ever go to university. I went to university where no one else from my school had ever been before. And it was just all through my life, it was like, okay, this is scary, but I'm just going to do it and see what happens. And when in 2007, when my husband Nigel said to me, I really want to start a business. I want to do a tech startup. I'm like, oh, okay, this is not an ideal time. I have a newborn baby and a toddler and a big mortgage. This is really, like, there's never a great time to start a business, but that definitely wasn't great.
Especially that year, 2007, yeah, with exactly what we knew was coming, you know, in the next couple of years.
Right.
So, okay, so let's start and talk about that moment that you and Nigel is your husband, which I admire you for being able to work together. That's, I think, probably a major challenge too, but maybe it seems like it worked well for you guys. But in any case, he comes to you and what does he say?
He'd been discontent for a little while. I remember he used to read the pages of the Sunday Times in London and just be like, I could do this stuff. I could do this. And so when he eventually just came right out and said, I want to do this thing, I remember thinking, well, if we don't do this now, we'll probably never do it. And I definitely don't want either of us to look back with regret. Or I definitely didn't want him to look back and say, you stopped me from doing this. I could have been great if it hadn't been for you. Not that I think he would have done it, but, you know, I just didn't want him to feel that way. So I said to him, straight off the bat, I said, okay, let's do it. And he nearly fell off his chair when I said that.
He was waiting for the pushback, right? He's like, what are you, nuts? We got a baby and, like, you better go pay the mortgage.
Yeah, so that was the start. And over the following 10 years, we built what would become FanDuel.
Which, as our listeners know, became this mega fantasy daily play site, $1 billion valuations. But did the business start as FanDuel? What was the original idea?
The original idea was not FanDuel. FanDuel was a result of a pivot. Our first idea was a prediction game. So you were predicting the outcome of news stories, user-generated content, and like a stock market for news stories. It was fun. Journalists loved it. We grew really quickly, but we couldn't figure out how to monetize it. We had all these ideas about how it might work, but it was a free game, free to play, and pretty much impossible.
And did it keep track? Was it where a pundit or someone would say or make a prediction? And you would see, you would bet if it was going to come true, and you can kind of evaluate what these people were saying and how accurate they were.
It was less about the pundits and more about you as an individual would ask a question on the site, and then you would see the market of the answers.
Ah.
So for example, when will Donald Trump be impeached? and back then it was the presidential election of 2008. And you would watch the market over time as the news stories changed and broke. And it was fun. It was a lot of fun and easy to play. But what we realized in 2009 was, okay, the market is a very different place now, for a start, as you alleged to the 2008 crash. And then we said, okay, we've already taken $1 million in VC money. As soon as you start taking money from VCs, this clock starts ticking.
Sure.
And you really have to find a way to make some money from this, particularly when your first round of funding comes from a UK-based company in 2008. They are very concerned about what's next month's revenue looking like right off the bat. It's a very different environment to what you would have seen in Silicon Valley in those days.
Yeah, I think a lot of that now changing back again with WeWork right. and these situations,
right.
and it's not about eyeballs, and but what is the real business model? And what was the real
right.
business model with
yes.
this company?
We didn't really have one.
Right.
I mean, we had lots of ideas
right.
of what it might be, but we couldn't figure out how to make any of them happen quickly enough because we didn't have a ton of runway. So 2009, we pivoted into what would become FanDuel. What we noticed was that within our prediction market platform, the sports section was where all the liquidity was. Everyone was tripping over themselves to get involved with that. And none of us who started this company together, there were five of us, none of us were American. We were based in Scotland.
I love it.
And we,
did you learn about NFL football rather quickly?
I mean, the learning curve was ridiculous. It went from what does NFL stand for and what shape is that ball to meeting team owners and players within a few years' time and Googling on the fly who this team was and what I should know about them. So that was a steep learning curve. But what we saw was that the area of fantasy sports had not been innovated in for many years. There were the big incumbents like ESPN and Yahoo, and there was an area ripe for disruption. And through a process of doing a lot of customer interviews, we were able to pinpoint what the pain points were and build an entirely new industry from scratch.
So how did you get started?
How did we get started? We developed an MVP in a spreadsheet and posted ads on Craigslist for people who understood what this game was and just did a lot of interviews. And yeah, it was hard. And building an entirely new industry is very different to deciding to, I don't know, sell something online.
Sure.
Like some tapping into an existing demand is very different to generating the demand in the first place. So back then it was equivalent of asking somebody to change their bank account because they were so entrenched in the leagues that they always played. It was just, it's such a cultural phenomenon how you play fantasy sports. You do it with all your college buddies once a year on ESPN.
Yep.
That's what you do. So we had to do a lot of engagement in terms of education about what this new product was, which took a bit of time and it was very, very hard. I remember 2010 sitting on a park bench in Edinburgh with tears running down my face, saying to Nigel, I just can't get people to play this game. And he said, all we need is three people who will pay us each day and we'll be okay.
That's great. So you're probably like going out and like hitting up people in the park.
Well, we were in Scotland and our market was America.
I love
so
that.
So that was, you couldn't just call up your neighbors or your uncle or your cousins and say, could you play this game? It was literally, okay, how do we find people in America who are going to play this game?
So how did it start to take off?
Well, back in those days, we didn't have Facebook advertising. Online advertising was very, very different. So we, in the early days, we did a lot of radio advertising. We actually did print magazines, all the baseball and the football magazines. We did ads in those magazines. And the ads were educational. We had a lot
you
of explaining to do.
Yeah.
And FanDuel's not a straightforward product. It's, you know, you need to learn the rules and what each player is worth and how the scoring works.
Yeah, because before then, you know, fantasy football, like you said, or fantasy sports was you get together with your buddies, you have a league on ESPN or Yahoo or CBS Sportsline
right.
at the time. And right. it was basically
about draft.
Yeah, draft, yeah. full season.
Mm-hmm.
But this was kind of
right.
A daily
yeah.
fantasy
yeah.
sports
yeah.
and it caught on.
Right.
And tell me, so you have to re-educate a market, you're spending money, but how much capital had you raised at at the time? Like, how did you have the dollars to actually get the word out here in the States? And how did you even know what magazines to go to or what radio stations to play your ads on? And I assume it was just you running this at
the
time.
Yeah, it was. I did. Every time any of us went to the US, we literally raided Hudson News for, you know, where all the magazines that we might be featured in. So it was really grassroots. I did a lot of Googling to understand how do you market, and found some trusted advisors and just learned the ropes. And yeah, it was very much build it brick by brick.
And as you did that and built it brick by brick, I know one of the things that FanDuel was able to do was raise an incredible amount of money. And when did the tide kind of turn where you went from that grassroots to like, we need to get this out there and, you know, the three people a day have to start playing to, hey, we've got something?
I think the moment that I realized, so let me just say, I think most entrepreneurs live a life where it feels like nothing is ever working. Like every day, your head's down, you're building something, you're never really sure, you're never comfortable.
Totally agree.
So for us, the moment came, and I remember it vividly, the moment came where I thought, actually, we're going to be okay. This is going to work. It wasn't until 2014, the end of 2014, we'd done our first deal with a professional sports team, and it was the Orlando Magic. And we were standing in the stadium, which was surrounded in FanDuel brand marketing. And we stood in the middle of the court. And I looked around and I said, oh my gosh, I think this might actually work. And up until that point, and we'd been at it for 7 years at that point, we had never really, it wasn't that we didn't believe in the vision. It was just this sense of fear that it wouldn't work.
Exactly. And I mean, it's so funny you relate that story. It just reminded me of my business, my first business. I remember we used to do a lot of events at the Super Bowl, and we would take a lot of clients to the Super Bowl. We would do experiences. And I just remember we actually one time had to buy an ad in stadium. It was at the Superdome in New Orleans. And I just remember this was years ago, like 2000, I forget, early 2000s. And I remember looking up and on the scoreboard with the media buy that we did, it said, "Welcome Tuchman Sports Enterprises." And I was like, it was kind of one of the first times I was like, oh my God, no matter what, no one can take that away from me. My business name was up there at the Super Bowl. And like, but it's amazing as an entrepreneur how it's 7 years in and you're like, is this going to be successful? And still, but I think that's so important for entrepreneurs because it continues to drive you. And so many great entrepreneurs I talk to, they never really say, I've arrived, I'm a success. It's always about getting to that next level. Uh-huh. And it seems like that was the case with you. But at this time, you're in Orlando, you're looking around, and that's when you just felt like, hey, we're onto something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think it's important as an entrepreneur that you remember on your journey, and it's not about the destination, it's about the journey. We all know that, which is easier said than done.
So true.
But it's really, really important to celebrate the moments of success. Even if they're small moments, it's important to remind yourself and the team that you're doing the right thing. This is just remember to have faith in what you're doing and celebrate those tiny moments. It's very easy because you're moving so quickly to forget to celebrate those little moments.
I agree with you so much. It's funny about being about the journey, and it's so hard because as an entrepreneur and building a business, you're always just trying to build something bigger, better, get to the point where maybe eventually one day you might sell the business, and you forget to like enjoy those things. And then when it's all over after you've maybe built a business and sold it, and think back, yeah, that's a great feeling, but like, did I really enjoy each of those things? And it's funny now myself being out of this business that I just left after 20 years for 3 months, being like, I miss those, like the locker room, the daily, the fun stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, that's what life's about.
Right.
Right.
Yeah,
that's what
exactly.
You remember.
Exactly. And that was a big takeaway for me. You know, I left FanDuel 2 years ago, and I mean, it was the craziest roller coaster ride imaginable. And we all left, the founders all left around about the same time. And we were pretty, broken's probably too strong a word, but we were pretty exhausted by the experience, shall we say. And the thing that really stuck with me was life's not about how much money you're going to make or how many billion-dollar companies you're going to build. It's about the relationships that you have with the people that you're working with, the people you live with, the people that are important in your life. And that was what inspired me to build my next company, which is all about relationships. Because if you want to feel successful in life, I mean, look at Adam Newman. He's made a lot of money.
Yeah, $1.7 billion.
Is that success? I don't feel for me that that would make me feel successful.
Yeah, I think it would make me, the way I look at that, yeah, I've made all this money, but like every day thinking you built something that really wasn't successful for so many people and was right. kind of this crazy,
right.
not Ponzi scheme, but this crazy
yeah.
business
yeah.
that, like, how does that make you feel?
Right.
And I totally agree with you. I think that that is so important and really the most important thing. And I think for you, I want to let our listeners know how you came to that point where you started your new business, because it makes completely sense. But take me back to Orlando and standing on the court and seeing FanDuel all around. And then take me, so what happens after that into the big build of the business? Because you guys become like present everywhere.
Well, I think to some people, it looked like this crazy overnight success. Suddenly in 2015, we were everywhere.
You were 8 years in, really.
Yes, exactly. And the way that we approached our growth was, you know, every year we would have a budget for what we wanted to spend on advertising. And we would really understand what the ROI was on that advertising. And the next year we would increase what we were going to spend. And it was a very analytical approach to how we were building the company. So it wasn't as if we suddenly went out and raised $250 million
and spent crazy, it all. Right, yeah.
It was, we were very, very focused on.
You had a method.
We had a method. We had discipline because of our roots. Taking money from a UK-based investor, you had to have discipline right from the outset. So all this talk nowadays, or the past month, I would say, about how suddenly everyone's focused, or the VC world is focused on a path to profitability, that was our modus operandi from the beginning. And 2015, we spent 3x what we'd spent the year before on advertising and marketing. So it wasn't as if suddenly we dropped hundreds of millions of dollars out of nowhere. So yeah, you know, we were in a battle for market share in 2015.
Yeah, they'll talk about that, because then all of a sudden DraftKings becomes
right.
your big rival, which is, I believe, a US-based business.
They're in Boston.
Business,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
and how does that play into, does it become a race? And
right.
and then I know down the line, as you grew, there was an opportunity to merge that I guess the federal government called off because
right.
they looked at it as a monopoly.
Yes.
But what was that time frame like, and what happens with you and DraftKings?
So going into 2015, we knew that if we wanted to maintain our market share, and going into 2015, we had around 70% market share. And there were really only two of us as contenders for the market. So we had to make a decision. We'd heard that DraftKings were out to raise $500 million and they were planning to spend it on advertising. So we had to make a decision as a board, do we allow that to happen? And they take market share and leave us with maybe 20% market share? Or do we decide, you know what, we want to have at least 50% of this market and we're going to battle for it? And as a board, we made that decision. Yes, we will go out and raise money and we will take them on. And that's what we did. And that was, you know, the result of that was every 2 minutes during NFL of 2015, you will have seen an ad for either DraftKings or FanDuel.
100%. I remember because I had my business at the time. And again, we do like these experiences and trips to the Super Bowl.
Right.
So I remember calling you guys and being like, hey, why don't you buy these Super Bowl trips and we'll give them out as prizes. And like, there was tons of interest at the time. And it was just like, you guys were all over. I just remember being on my sales guys, like, call FanDuel, call DraftKings. Like, they're spending money. But
yeah.
it seemed like that. And then what happens?
So in November 2015, whenever you stick your head above the parapet like that, people are going to set up a notice. So early 2015, our general counsel was out trying to talk with AGs, trying to say, look, we're doing this thing in fantasy sports. We would love to talk with you about how we can make sure that this sector is regulated and behaves. You know what you're doing as a business, but you don't know what your competitors are doing. And how do you make sure that everyone is good actors?
You knew
in this
space? Had to resolve this to right. really become that.
Right,
company.
Exactly. But the legal entities, whether it's AGs or whoever it was, they didn't care.
Yeah.
Start 2015, they were like, yeah, it's fantasy sports, whatever. Right. We've got bigger fish to fry right. here. And it was only when we combined, spent hundreds of millions of dollars on advertising that they then sat up and said, oh, okay, we're going to pay attention now because there's a lot of money here. And November 2015 was when the AG in New York, Schneiderman, came out and said, not on my watch, you're not going to do this. So that was a really tough time. We'd gone from an all-out battle for market share to switching off all of the advertising and really hunkering down and figuring out how do we resolve the legal situation.
Yeah, that was all the business, both businesses,
yes,
right, Drafting?
Yes,
it was kind of
yes.
like you were on the same side
right.
trying to figure out
yes.
how do we make this
right.
a legitimate like
right.
business.
Yeah, and we'd gone from being sort of arch rivals to, okay, let's figure out the communication strategy here. Let's figure out how we join up because the legal fees became very expensive. And that was the first step towards the proposed merger, which, as you said, the FTC blocked in 2017.
So they say, you guys can't do this because you'd be the dominant, you'd
right.
be the dominant player.
Yeah,
like 90%,
yeah, yeah.
I think it was market share.
Right, yes.
More from our guest, but first, a word from our sponsors. Payroll and benefits are hard, especially for small businesses. You don't have the time to be an expert in things like taxes and regulations. And old school payroll providers just aren't built for the way you work today. Gusto is making payroll, benefits, and HR easy for small businesses. Modern technology does the heavy lifting, so it's easy to get things right. And why is Gusto better than the other guys? Well, PC Mag and Fit Small Business have called Gusto the best payroll for small businesses. Gusto also makes payroll a breeze. In fact, 9 out of 10 users say Gusto is easier to use than other payroll solutions. Gusto saves you time. 72% of customers spend less than 5 minutes to run payroll. Don't believe it? Just Google them. People love Gusto. How often do you actually love your payroll provider? That is true. So, most small businesses don't have an HR expert, but you don't need one to use Gusto. With great software and great service, you can focus on your business, not payroll and paperwork. And you no longer have to be a big company to get great technology, great benefits, and great services for your team. So, to help support the show, Gusto is offering our listeners an exclusive, limited-time deal. Sign up today, and you'll get 3 months free once you run your first payroll. Just go to gusto.com/HSH. And our next sponsor. Getting your master's degree can open up a whole new world of opportunities. Better jobs, more advancement. A master's degree can help you be a whole new you. And now's the best time to make it happen with help from Ashford University. Convenient and flexible, Ashford University's online master's degree programs allow you to learn at your own pace. You can study wherever you're the most comfortable learning. One course at a time, Ashford University's 6-week-long courses allow you to take one course at a time. Being enrolled in one class at Ashford means you are considered a full-time student. And easy enrollment. The GRE, GMAT, and other standardized test scores are not required for enrolling at Ashford University. And of course, accreditation. Ashford University is fully accredited by WASC Senior College and University Commission. New opportunities are right around the corner. Now's the time to start earning your master's degree. Enroll now by going to ashford.edu/HSH. That's ashford.edu/HSH to start your master's degree today. Again, ashford.edu/HSH. And we're back. So then where do you pivot from that point? And this is, what year is this?
This was summer 2017.
So 17, which
right.
isn't too long ago.
Right.
So then what happens to you at that point?
The second half of 2017, actually all the founders left the company. And
did you leave at that time because you didn't think you could win that battle, or was it just time, or what was the reason?
It was time. And the private equity investors that we had brought in decided to merge with Paddy Power Betfair in a deal where...
This is a big European...
Yes, bookmaker.
Yes, yeah. Bookmaker.
And this was at the time when PASPA was repealed.
Right, which is the making sports gambling legal.
Right, okay. At federal level.
Which, at a federal level, which for you guys, you always had to work around that, right? As, and this was a, when that happened, I mean, that's a major
right.
milestone for your businesses
right.
because all of a sudden you can open this up to
yes.
real money.
Yes, exactly, exactly. And what we've seen since then is that FanDuel has gone from strength to strength as each state legalizes sports betting, and it's become the number one sports betting company in the US.
Okay, so to get to that point, you build this incredible business. It starts with you and your husband out of, I'm sure, a tiny space in Edinburgh, Scotland.
Right.
It becomes this major, major business now. But I know as part of the story that's out there, you guys kind of got pushed out and really didn't make any money or to a certain degree or capitalize on this entire business that now is so big and incredible. Like, as an entrepreneur, how does that make you feel? Like, that's hard.
Yeah, it is hard. And I could go into the whole story of how it happened, but I'd rather not.
Okay. All right.
But the thing that really upsets, there's two things that really upset me. And that's, first of all, a feeling of betrayal. And the second one is, you know, like I said earlier, none of us get into this game to make lots of money. That's not why
right.
we did it. That was not the motivating factor behind any of this. But hundreds of our employees who had paid to buy their options were also left with nothing.
Right. Because they didn't have the preferred shares. Was it basically the,
right.
there's different,
all
when,
of the
when
common
a VC
shareholders,
or PE company
right.
comes in, they get paid out first.
Right. All of the common shareholders were left with nothing.
Right.
And basically the deal was a deal that meant that the investor directors were selling FanDuel to themselves at a price that they chose.
Okay. So I'm sure they chose a really low price.
Yes.
That's what I would do, but I wouldn't do that.
Right, right, right. Yeah. So it's not the outcome any of us wanted.
Yeah.
And I've learned a lot of lessons in terms of who I want to take money from in the future. So I thought about what I wanted to do after FanDuel. That was my number one thing. Yes, I do have the guts and the stomach to go back into another startup.
Did that, like, after this situation, were you kind of like turned off? Or, you know, it's amazing because I love your story. It's so gritty where you have this thing happen to you, but you get back up and go out there. Not only that, you go out there and you raise money again.
Right. Yeah. And I think that was the thing, you know, after I left FanDuel, I did take a few months to relearn how to breathe, shall we say. And we had no choice. We had to get back up. We didn't make any money from FanDuel. So what were we going to do?
Yeah. Like, and you have this family.
We have three children and we still have a mortgage. And, you know, let's pick ourselves back up, dust ourselves off and get back out there and do it again. And that's what I did, with the one caveat that I will only take money from investors with integrity.
How do you know, though, if they have integrity?
That's a really good question. And that's the one piece of advice that I give early stage entrepreneurs. It's make sure that you do thorough due diligence on whoever it is that's giving you money. Because if they have control over your business, which when you're raising hundreds of millions of dollars, in most cases, you do have to cede control to the investors. If they don't have integrity, they're going to make decisions that you fundamentally don't agree with.
Right.
Decisions that lead to your employees and your team who have built the company getting screwed over. And that's not the kind of company that I want to
build. That's the worst situation of everything. You know, when my business is, for the most part, we've always self-funded and I didn't even realize, I mean, they were small businesses or, you know, became medium-sized businesses, but the money you're talking about raising, you were rechanging an industry and raising hundreds of millions of dollars. Like, you have to give that up? And I would imagine just with your employees, like for you as the person you are, who's really genuine, like that's got to weigh on you so much when they do that.
Right. And, you know, that was one of the reasons we left. Our reputation is more important than money. And you can see that in a grand scale with Adam Newman. For us, we had to do the right thing. We had to do the right thing by our employees.
Yep.
And that was the decision that we made.
And it's true. Life goes fast. At the end of the day, you know, one thing going now in middle age and realizing is like dollars. I mean, if you're fortunate enough where you can feed yourself, feed your kids, pay a mortgage, have a comfortable lifestyle, where a lot of people do, a lot of people don't in this country. But like at the end of the day, what's the difference in those dollars? At the end of the day, all you have is your name, your reputation.
Right.
And going back to what you said earlier, it's about those relationships. And it sounds like you learn that on your journey and you come out of this, you jump back in and tell us how you came up with your new business idea and exactly what it is.
Mm-hmm. So it was in those few months after I left FanDuel, it was a chance to reflect, like, what is success and how do you feel successful? And I thought about it for a long time. And for me, it was the strength of relationships that you have with people in your life. That's all that really matters. That makes you feel successful and it makes you feel happy. And those two, for me, go hand in hand. And I started to think, so, you know, recently, technology has had a really bad press, and rightly so, in terms of destroying relationships. More and more people are feeling disconnected to the people in their own house or, you know, the important people in their lives, at the same time as they're more and more connected with people in the wider world.
Yeah.
You know, you might have thousands of friends online, in inverted commas, and you spend every evening sitting on the sofa beside the person
or
the people that you love and ignoring them
and
being completely distracted by the thing in your hand. So I started to think, is there a way that we can use technology to try to reverse that and make people feel more connected with the people that are important in their lives? And obviously, it's ironic that our first product that we've developed is an app, but you're on your phone anyway.
Yeah.
So let's meet people where they're at.
Meet people where they're at. No, it's ironic, but it really, if you really want to solve this problem, it's not technology, it's how you use technology.
Right, exactly. So what we've developed is we're a relationship wellness company. And the first app that we've developed, it's called Relish. And it's really about for you and your partner, whoever that is, whether it's your husband, your wife, your girlfriend, your boyfriend, whatever gender or non-gender.
You can be whatever you're doing. It's
right?
All good.
It's
you
all
use
good.
This is
for you. So it's personalized relationship advice to you as an individual.
Is it like a therapist that works with you?
Right. So it's two things. First of all, there's a machine learning based relationship advice plan that you get, and you have access to a relationship coach who's a real person and you can text anytime. My ingoing thesis was that people show up in couples therapy, far too late. So the damage is already done.
It's more not preventative. It's more let's fix this mess.
Right. And it's completely broken.
Not that I have
stage.
Any experience there. But.
So people show up too late. And they also show up and say to the therapist, you need to fix us. Or worse, you need to fix that person over there.
Right. Which I'm sure is like 99% of the time, fix the person over there.
Right. So this product, Relish, is giving you control over your relationship rather than relying on a therapist or somebody else changing. It's about how can I learn to change my mindset, my perception, my self-care regime, and the way I show up and react in this particular relationship.
Yeah, because I think at the end of the day, in life and relationships, one thing that I've slowly learned and really trying to embrace fully is that can only change yourself at the end of the day.
Yes.
I got two kids that are really proving that to me right now.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's amazing when you implement some of the lessons that we're teaching people, it's amazing to see the change that happens in your relationship as a result of you doing the work on yourself.
Yeah.
Now, the way Relish is set up, you can invite your partner to join as well. It's a buy one, get one free deal.
Sure, sure.
But you don't have to. That's the whole point.
What if you have more than one partner?
We have been asked. Okay, okay. We have been asked. We do have polyamorous people
all right.
Use Relish.
All right, you're
at the
open
moment,
to
it's
good.
Not it's not entirely possible, but it's on
you
the roadmap.
Have like a Google Hangout or whatever you think. So let me ask you. I mean, this is a fantastic idea. And it really seems like it came about because of everything you went through. Like, you started a business with your husband and you went through these relationships with private equity folks.
Right.
And did the business, like, because it's such a, what I love about your story and what I admire about entrepreneurs like yourself is like me, myself, I've always been in one business, you know, sports experience. You just went from FanDuel to like the opposite, right? Like how did this idea come about? Was it a big driver from your history and you were just like, I need to do this?
So I think the thing that always surprises people when they first meet me is I don't like sports. And I mean, I love sports for other people.
Do you have a favorite NFL team now by any chance?
No.
Like, did one team work with you and they were really cool? Or you could care less?
I love the Orlando Magic because they're our first team.
All right. So you'll always
be a Magic fan. It's got nothing to do with the basketball.
Okay.
It's like, I just really like the people.
Yes.
And I think for me, I always felt disingenuous. I always felt like I wasn't authentic to myself. I had to Google this particular team owner that I was about to meet or the players that I was about to meet. And, you know, for some people, working at FanDuel was the be all and end all. It was the most exciting job they could ever imagine.
I would think like so many people and guys I know specifically, like who were in my office because they were playing it all day anyway. And I'd have to walk by that computer screen and be like, what are you doing?
Right. Exactly.
Get off that.
Exactly.
So I am sure they would have probably signed up for free.
Right. Right. Exactly. So I wanted my next venture to be something that I deeply cared about. And don't get me wrong, I deeply, deeply cared about FanDuel and fantasy sports. And I was the most competitive person in the office, in our office leagues. Like, if I was in it, I was going to win it.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that. You guys had your own leagues.
100%.
All right.
But I was able to use my brain over my heart. In terms of, I'm just not going to pick the teams
you
that I love or the players that I love.
That's why you're so good, because my problem is I always pick the teams I like and the teams I like suck.
Right.
Just like the New York Jets right now. It's so hard because I pick the teams that I like and it sways. I think a lot of gamblers, if you're basically professionals, you can't like
a team.
You
can't allow your heart to get involved with daily fantasy decisions.
But so many people do.
So going into Relish, I wanted to do two things. First of all, was do something that was authentic to who I am. And the second thing was really, I was in this space after the craziness of FanDuel, I was in this space where I literally wanted to give the world a hug. I wanted to make people feel better because I had been through so much and my co-founders and my team, we'd all been through so much. And I just felt this overriding mission of, I just want to make people feel better. And how can I do that?
I love that.
So that was the genesis of coming up with the idea for Relish.
I love it. I mean, it just talks to you as a person that, like you said from the beginning, not about the money. And with this business now, really about the journey and making people feel good. And I love that. And I am sure you're going to be extremely successful. Tell me now, because you have some backers that are good folks. I know Trinity is involved and they're great people.
Right.
And what is it now with these backers where you think you'll be able to grow this and what's the vision?
Yeah, we have Trinity Ventures as a seed investor and Bullpen Capital. Paul Martino from Bullpen was the first US money that we took for FanDuel. And as soon as I told him I was doing something new, he was all in.
He didn't even want to know what it was.
I don't even care. I'm going to back you.
And as he should. And I said, but give him credit for coming on board
Paul's
early.
Amazing. Yes. So they've both been incredibly supportive. And I think the thing that got Trinity very excited, and you know, a lot of investors that I've spoken to are very excited about. It's this whole idea of wellness is just such an important category at the moment. And I think even in the last year, we've just seen this tide of mental health issues that are affecting so many people. And when it comes down to it, often the underlying issue, whether it's mental health or whether it's any kind of addiction, the underlying issue is some kind of broken or dysfunctional relationship. So rather than trying to treat the symptoms, I'm trying to treat what's the underlying reason for some of these dysfunctions. And if we can figure that out and not just fix broken relationships, but also become the preventative tool to keep things healthy. That's the vision. Like, how do we as a society ensure that those relationships are as strong as they can possibly be?
Yeah, and I agree with you wholeheartedly on the wellness front. It's so great to see this industry emerging. I mean, it's incredible when you look at numbers and the amount of dollars in every different type of front being poured into it, from technology or boutique fitness or health products and CBD. And I mean, it's great because I think people are realizing, and you have to take care of yourself, especially what's happened with technology, where you find people pulling away more from other people. And what you need and what people need is community and relationships.
Right.
And most importantly, you need that internally with yourself.
Uh-huh. Yes.
And it sounds like for you, that is where you really see the growth opportunity for Relish and people really taking care of themselves.
Right, right. And I think, you know, there's a lot of talk at the moment about self-care, which is fantastic. And it's a great foundation for everything that you do. But what's the next step? How do you take self-care, but also grow? Because there's a danger if you focus too much on self, you kind of coddle yourself and, you know, it's all about treating yourself and buying the latte
right. And
taking a bubble bath,
getting,
you know,
massage,
it's like
just self.
That's great. But what's the next stage? How do you as a person grow? And where is the us care, which is the next step on from self-care? And that's what Relish is about. It's about how do you look after yourself and your relationship with this other person.
It sounds like you as a child could have really benefited from an app like this, going back to how we started with being an introvert and having this fear. You really pushed yourself, but not a lot of people would ever do that. They would go crawl into a hole and live their lives from, and so many people do. But it sounds like for you, this business now is really about something maybe that you probably wanted to do ever since you were a kid.
It's not something that I've thought about or processed, but yeah, I mean, I guess.
I'm also a psychiatrist, by the way. I do that in my spare time. After this, I'll be billing you for $500, but no.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's really like a friend holding your hand as you're going on this journey. You know that your relationship is valuable, and how do you optimize that relationship into the best version of itself? And yeah, I'm very excited about where it can go.
And today with you, do you find, going back to this challenge you face with being an introvert, and do you think you're at a place now where you're completely over that? Is it still a daily challenge? I know you said you still, like, how much of that do you work on, and how much of that affects you now as the sole owner of this business that you're out in the public constantly? Mm-hmm. I mean, you're doing this podcast.
Right. I don't think it's something that ever completely leaves you. I think I take strength from being by myself. And that's effectively what an introvert is.
Extroverts take strength from being with other people and the buzz of that.
And I think the first step to growth is to understand what kind of a person are you. And one of the things that Relish does when you sign up is you take an assessment that helps you understand how secure you are in your relationships. And understanding that attachment type is really important because then you can get the right type of advice for what you need. So for me, I'm a cat. We have four different animal types. I'm a cat, and a cat likes their independence. They like to be alone. They need alone time. But what does that mean if you're with a cat? How do you help that cat become more secure and attached in that relationship?
What are the other?
We have a dog, a cat, a rabbit, and a cockatoo.
And what are, what was the last one?
Cockatoo.
Cockatoo. Okay. Yeah. Now, what are their...
to do with how it's on two axes, anxiety and avoidance.
Ah.
So if you're high in anxiety and low in avoidance, you're a cockatoo, which means you need to be around people and you need constant reassurance. So, you know, each animal has its own type of advice that we've developed. And we combine that with things like love languages and really understanding the relationship that you're in.
Right.
And you get that customized advice for you.
And what's the dog in the, what was the?
The dog is where you're low in anxiety and low in avoidance. So you're pretty much the perfect person.
Yeah.
Like my husband.
Your husband, not me.
And then if you're high in anxiety and high in avoidance, you're a rabbit.
I see.
Where you're not really sure what you need. You want to be close to somebody one day and then you're pulling away the next day. So,
just a lot of people.
Right.
That's why it's so great that you have built or getting out there and building this business right now. And we wish you a ton of luck. I know, knowing you, and one thing I've always learned and learned the hard way is you invest in people.
Right.
And it sounds like Paul did that, knowing with you. And it's like that's what you need to do. So knowing you, I know this is going to be another successful venture.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for being on.
Thanks for having me.
And that's our episode. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to How Success Happens wherever you get your podcasts. We come out with a new episode every Wednesday morning, and you don't want to miss it. And if you like to share, please feel free to pass along the show to an entrepreneur friend who could use a boost, and I could always use the subscribers. And do you have ideas for guests? I always love to hear about great entrepreneurs. If you know anyone, shoot me an email at hsh@entrepreneur.com or on Twitter at Robert Tuchman, that's RobertTuchman, or even send me a message on LinkedIn. How Success Happens is a production of Entrepreneur Media. Be sure to visit entrepreneur.com for insight on building your business, or even better yet, subscribe to our magazine. No joke, I found my first job after reading about a company in Entrepreneur Magazine back in the 1990s. It's always been my absolute favorite magazine for entrepreneurs. Thanks for listening and spending some time with me today. Until next time, my name is Robert Tuchman, just a fellow entrepreneur and your host. See you soon.